Jet noise, a very critical parameter is the speed of the flow. So if you can produce the power that you need in order to lift the airplane up and so on and propel it forward, while at the same time keep the velocity of the flow smaller, then you have a winning combination. You can produce more thrust, but less noise.
I'm Russ Altman, and today, Professor Sanjeev Lele tells us how the field of fluid mechanics is addressing problems ranging from the noise created by jet airplanes to the efficiency of wind farms. By using extremely precise simulations of fluid flows, both air and water, his group can help understand the physics of how fluids move, mix, and make noise. It's the future of fluid mechanics. Fluid mechanics and fluid dynamics are the studies of how fluids behave, the physics of fluids, if you will. Two of the most basic concepts in fluid flow are laminar flow and turbulent flow. Laminar flow is smooth, quiet, and orderly. Think about a slow-moving river where a floating stick flows a smooth, lovely path down the stream. Turbulent flow is more random, involves mixing, and big differences in pressure, and can be loud. Think about the water at the bottom of a waterfall and what our little floating stick will experience if it falls down the fall. Computational methods for understanding and predicting the behavior of fluids is critical for many systems. For example, airplanes create turbulent airflow and noise as they fly, and especially as they land and take off. But we will learn airplanes have gotten quieter in the last 30 years thanks to some of these technologies. Similarly, wind turbine farms have all kinds of challenges in the placement of those windmills so they don't interfere with one another. Well, Professor Sanjeev Lele is a professor of aeronautics and astronautics and of mechanical engineering at Stanford University. His group applies simulation techniques broadly, but many of their applications are guided by an interest in sustainability and environmental impact mitigation. Sanjeev, let's start out with a very basic question. What got you interested in fluid mechanics in the first place?
Well, I mean, as I was doing my undergraduate degree, I got exposed to the broad range of applications that fluid mechanics applies to. And so that got me started. And so I started learning more about it.
Now, people who are not familiar with fluid mechanics might need a little bit of a definition of what is inbounds, what is the main interest and focus of fluid mechanics and the research, not so much the application areas, but for starters, what is the general approach to fluid dynamics?
Well, so fluid mechanics is a very broad subject and so on. It deals with fluid motions in general. And so fluids can be whatever they are in many applications. So if you're thinking about air transportation, then the aircraft is flying through the atmosphere. So air is the medium. That is the fluid that is going over the aircraft. If you're dealing with underwater applications and so on, then water is the fluid that is of interest. Of course, there are many more complex fluids that arise in biological applications or in also other technological applications. Fluids need not be just water and air, but I think we all understand what a fluid is. Yes. Fluid dynamics is the science which allows us to predict the outcome of fluid motion in terms of forces that it produces on bodies. In terms of an application that is near and dear to me is the sound that flows produce and so on. Another application that is of interest to me is how do wind turbines work and so on, and what can we do to improve their performance in the context of a wind farm?
Yes. So this, you've just listed all the things that I now would love to get into, and we can actually do it in the order that you actually suggested. So let's start out with this field that I've learned in preparation for our conversation is called aeroacoustics. Fascinating. I have had the privilege of growing up near John F. Kennedy Airport as a child and now living near San Francisco Airport as an adult. So I am extremely familiar with the sounds that can come out of airplanes. And indeed, as you will know very well, when I was a young child growing up in New York, there was something called the supersonic transport that flew directly over my home in Long Island. So let's start out. Give me an overview of aeroacoustics, and then let's get right into the questions that your group is asking about it.
So aeroacoustics is the science of sound and how sound is produced by flows and so on. In aeroacoustics, we are dealing with air flows over airplanes or other technology. So the governing principle is that it is the unsteady behavior in the flow. If the flow is just laminar and steady, then it doesn't produce any sound. The flow fluctuates, and it is the fluctuations in the flow which cause forces to fluctuate that are exerted on bodies and turbulence that may be present in the flow. Turbulence, we all intuitively sort of have a feeling that it's irregular and chaotic and so on. So when there is that chaotic flow going on, then there are little elements of fluid are being compressed and expanding and so on in chaotic random ways and so on. And that produces sound that converts some of the mechanical energy into acoustic energy, which propagates away as waves.
Yes. So it's very interesting because it's obvious now that you say it, but I have never observed a turbulent situation that wasn't also making noise. And I guess they come part and parcel together. So when I look at turbulence, when I look at a waterfall, it's loud. And when I look at a jet flying by, it's loud. Just so I can understand from more of a layperson's view, is the sound, because you said it's from the compression and decompression of the matter, like the water or the air, and that's the basic cause for the sound itself?
Those are the sound waves that are transmitting that sound further and further away. So the question is, why can't the flow just move in the way it is moving and not produce the sound? And so, I mean, basically, in a flow, there is pressure variation. You can imagine that the pressure is higher, that pushes the fluid towards the region of lower pressure. And so as the pressure is changing, fluid is also expanding and shrinking in response to pressure. And so that's essentially creation of sound. I've very simplified the picture and so on. But I think intuitively, that would be a way to think about it.
So I think I know enough to know that there's a different set of issues for jets that are subsonic versus jets that are supersonic. So let's start with normal jets that we're seeing in 2022. Because I know that one of your interests is, I believe, tell me if this is wrong, not only understanding where this sound comes from, but if there are ways to make it less noisy. Because of, as you know, people who live like I have for my entire life near airports care about this. What are the opportunities to use knowledge of these flows and these sounds to actually change how things work today?
Right. So again, I think we should think about subsonic applications where the flow is moving at a speed which is smaller than the speed of sound, and other situations where it is supersonic, because the character of some additional processes that produce sound arise in supersonic flows, which don't exist for lower speed flows. So you were asking about opportunities for impacting the design so that the flows produce less noise.
Yes.
And one very popular way, which has been key to the success of aviation over the last many decades, is that it's been possible to have bigger engines that are able to power larger airplanes, carry more passengers, but at the same time, the sound that they produce has gone down. So if you go back to the beginning of the jet age from 707 down, so you may have experienced this.
Yes, I did.
Living close to JFK, that although the traffic has grown a lot, the noise has actually gone down. And the reason that has been possible is because the jet engine diameters, the size has grown, which means that the speed of the exhaust has gone down. And for jet noise, a very critical parameter is the speed of the flow. So if you can produce the power that you need in order to lift the airplane up and so on and propel it forward, while at the same time keep the velocity of the flow smaller, then you have a winning combination. You can produce more thrust but less noise.
That really does make sense. So these big engines with the big diameters, they're able to move the same amount of material, but they can perhaps move it at lower speeds.
That's right. They have the same thrust or same momentum that is being pushed, but they have smaller velocity, and so noise is less for that reason.
Does the design of the airplane itself also impact the noise, or is that a relatively minor component of the noise?
Well, so the design of the airplane does make a difference to the noise, but it makes a bigger difference to the noise of the landing configuration. So when airplane is coming down to land, then it has these high lift systems that are deployed and the landing gear deployed and so on. And those are different noise sources than the engine noise, which is dominant when the aircraft is taking off. Yes. So other thing I would mention, an opportunity to reduce noise. You may have seen in the last 10 or so years, you see these chevrons where the back end of the nozzle engine is not just straight, but has some shape to it, some wavy pattern to it and so on. And it's basically tailoring the mixing of that jet with the surrounding in a more regular way. And so if you can make the flow more regular, you're kind of calming it down in some way and so on. And so that would help.
And if we, and for those of us who want to go look for these immediately after this conversation, this is at the very tail end of the plane. Is that where we see the chevrons?
Right, right. So the engine nozzle at the back. So on a 777, you can see this 787. You can see it, and so on. And so these are already flying on.
But the important point that I hear you making here is that the way that the exhaust from the nozzle of the jet, the way it interacts with the air in the atmosphere, that can be a very startling interaction. And if you can figure out a way to make it a little bit, I guess, laminar or less turbulent, you'll get a little bit less noise. Is that the idea?
To make it more orderly and so on.
Orderly.
So the way the jet exhaust interacts with the surrounding air is turbulent. Right. There's intense shear between the jet flow and the surrounding, and it's highly turbulent. But by shaping the jet exhaust in particular ways, one is able to control the scale at which that turbulence arises and so on. And human listening, human ear is very sensitive to sort of the frequency range of around 2 to 4 kilohertz and so on. So if you can push the sound to higher frequencies, the annoying sound to higher frequencies, it may be equally loud, but we hear it less.
Great. So it'll bother the dogs, but not the humans, maybe. Forgive me for that. But let's spend a moment on supersonic, because we don't actually see as much. I mean, I certainly don't. I was seeing supersonic twice a day for my entire childhood. But I know people are very curious about these sonic booms that you sometimes see at air shows. And can you just give us a quick tutorial about what's going on there? And I know it's very different from what we've just been discussing.
Well, so the supersonic aircraft have a jet exhaust, which is supersonic, going faster than the speed of sound. And so when a flow is supersonic, then it can actually trap waves that are inside the jet and not coming outside. And so then turbulence interacts with these waves that are trapped in the supersonic portion of the jet. It's like standing waves. And if the water is moving fast, you may have observed it, and you have a stone in the shallow water, which is, say, moving fast, you see patterns that are kind of stationary in the stream, which are waves that are fixed, and they are like a supersonic trapped wave inside a jet. But turbulence then interacts with it and jiggles it and so on. And so there's additional noise that is produced by the interaction of turbulence with shocks in a supersonic jet.
I see.
And so that makes a lot more racket, lot more annoying.
I don't even know. Is it a current research question to try to reduce that sound, or is that just not something that enough people care about?
Well, interestingly, it is. And the reason it is that although military aircraft that are using these supersonic engines and so on, engines with supersonic exhaust, they are not subject to the noise regulations that the civilian aircraft are. Over the years, the noise of military aircraft have not gone down, and in fact have gone up, because on the defense side, one is always pushing for greater performance, greater agility, and things like that, and so on. And so what has happened is that on aircraft carrier decks from which these fighter aircraft take off, there are ground personnel that have to give the final clearance for the aircraft to go, or when it is approaching for it to land. And it is these personnel, they're being exposed to these very high levels of noise. And so their hearing is being damaged in the process. And so that has really created a very significant interest in methods that could reduce the noise of military aircraft as well.
Great, great. This is The Future of Everything with Russ Altman. More with Sanjeev Lele next on SiriusXM Business Radio Channel 132. Welcome back to The Future of Everything. I'm Russ Altman, and I'm speaking with Professor Sanjeev Lele of Stanford University. In the last segment, Sanjeev explained how fluid mechanics impacts the generation of sounds from both subsonic and supersonic airplanes. In this segment, he will tell us how fluid mechanics can be used to increase the efficiency of wind farms that are generating electricity. He also describes how improved simulations will require a next generation of computers, maybe specifically built to do the types of computations that his group performs. But I wanted to move over to a new topic, because I know you also do a lot of work on wind turbines, these farms that are generating electricity from wind. You know, people see them and they're very lovely to look at as you're driving around the countryside. But what are the main questions that somebody like you with a fluid mechanics, fluid dynamics background, what are the issues in wind turbines that get your attention?
Well, I mean, wind is a great resource, is renewable, and when the sun is shining, there's solar energy that can also be used, but sun also produces wind in the first place, and so on. And so we can utilize it, and it doesn't require much other resource to be used, like water and so on, is not required for operation of wind turbines. So one of the sort of significant issues that has come up is in the setting of a farm, you have the wind developer has a certain amount of real estate on which the wind farm is developed. And so sometimes they may choose to place wind turbines that are close to each other, or they are behind each other, and so on. And the wind, of course, comes from different directions in different places, and so on. So if you have turbines that are in the wind shadow of another turbine, then the downstream turbine sees less of the wind and so on because of the fact that the upstream turbine has created a wake where there is less wind. And so the power that can be generated by a collection of many turbines can be significantly constrained by these wake shadows of upstream turbines. And just to give you a sense, this loss or performance that is not gained can be very large, can be almost like 60%, 40%, and so on, has been observed in some large-scale farms. And so it's really dramatic. Of course, in a more typical situation in terms of averaged over a whole year with wind coming from different directions, the numbers are not as staggering as that, because that would be the worst-case situation and so on. But if the
But we're talking about significant losses of potential energy that are lost because of perhaps non-optimal configuration of the windmills.
Correct.
So how do you approach this? I guess we haven't talked about it, but your expertise of your lab, one of your expertises is these very high fidelity simulations. Is this the kind of thing that you can then simulate before they build it?
So we do do simulations of interacting wakes of turbines so that we can see if we were to operate the upstream turbines a little bit differently, what gain can we have for the downstream turbine? What is the collective optimization that we could carry out if we were allowed to sort of tilt, say, the upstream turbine a little bit so that if you tilt it, yaw it in the wind instead of facing the wind straight head on, if you tilt it a little bit, then its effect is to steer the wake. The wake goes, instead of going straight back, it gets steered a little bit to the side. And so if the downstream turbine is just a little bit, just misses the wake, that's enough to have the performance gain that otherwise you would have lost. And so on one hand, we do large-scale simulations where the turbulence in the wakes and so on is all resolved, but then we also bring it down to engineering level models that can integrate with real-time control systems.
I would guess that the companies that build these turbines and then install them would be extremely interested in having access to some of these models. Is the vision that you would have models that are almost like plug and play, where a manufacturer could work with a customer and say, okay, we're going to use Dr. Lele's model and we're going to get you the best configuration? Or is that far off or just not going to happen for some other reason?
We are working with wind operators and so on for this. But I think the thing to keep in mind is that wind operators and so on, they have their proprietary information and so on. And they don't want to share that technology with other wind developers and so on. There are a number of companies and they have their own sort of proprietary things and so on. What we are doing, of course, is open research and so on. It's available to everyone and so on. And so if they're interested in collaboration, because the other aspect is that wind turbines, they want to be sure that anything they do in terms of change in the way they operate doesn't hurt the performance of the turbine over the long run. Because once you install it, you want to be able to use it for 10 years, 15 years, and so on. And so they want to make sure that there's no additional mechanism that would cause some degradation of the performance and so on. So they are kind of risk averse, but I think in working with them, if they see that, okay, they can evaluate the technology on machines that have been already operational for some years and so on.
Yes.
They can take a risk with hardware that has been out there for many years already. And then once it's proven there, then they could apply it to newer machines.
Yeah, no, what you're saying makes sense. For example, in the example that you gave of the yaw, you know, introducing some yaw, that might create pressures on the hardware that would change the wear pattern on the bearings and all that. And so they have to be very careful that they don't cause their machines. Okay, well, in preparing for our conversation, I noticed that you wrote a paper about the interaction of a wind turbine performance with the rotation of the Earth. And I'm wondering if you could just tell us what that paper was all about, because I was very surprised that an issue like the rotation of the Earth might actually impact a wind farm, but I guess I shouldn't have been surprised. Can you give a little thumbnail sketch of what that was all about?
Well, so yes, that may seem surprising. And if the wind turbine is small, then the Earth's rotation would not be expected to have any impact on its performance or the wake of it and so on. But over the years, in recent times, these wind farms have become quite large. The individual turbines themselves have become fairly sizable and so on, where the hub height is like 100 meters. The biggest blades are like 140 meters and so on.
Wow. Huge. All I can say is wow.
And so those machines are spinning and so on. And the turbines may be spaced by maybe 8 diameters apart or 10 diameters apart and so on, depending on the land cost and so on. And so the overall farm size can be quite large. And so it is at the farm scale that it's like in weather, small scale weather, the wind that we feel as individuals on the scale of an individual or on the scale of hundreds of meters, the effect of Earth's rotation is not appreciable. It's negligible.
Right.
But when you go to scales that are approaching kilometers and many kilometers and so on, that's sort of getting into the range of mesoscale. And as in weather, mesoscales and bigger scales are significantly affected by Earth's rotation. So on that
sense, and this paper showed some of those effects, I presume.
It showed that an approximation that is commonly made, and sometimes we call it traditional approximation, where at any point on the Earth where we're trying to describe the flow, we take only the component of Earth's rotation, which is normal to the ground. But Earth's rotation is along the north-south axis.
Yes.
It's not necessarily normal to the ground, if you imagine. So it has a horizontal component, and this effect is generally ignored. And it is okay for very large-scale applications, but is not okay for the applications that this sits in.
Great, great. Well, in our final minute, I just wanted to ask you about what's the future look like for your field? What are the big challenges, and what are you most excited about when you go into work in terms of the new technologies that you're developing and their applications?
So, I mean, one area that I'm very excited about working further on is how can we impact energy systems of the future using fluid dynamic simulations. And so one key difference in terms of these future technologies is that they may use fluids that are more complex than the fluids that have been used, and the pressure and temperature ranges over which the energy cycles operate will involve more complex thermodynamic effects that need to be taken into account while we describe the turbulent flows that are encountered and so on. So we are developing simulation methodologies that can handle thermodynamic complexity along with turbulence that is going to be expected in energy conversion devices in the first place. And the other direction that is very common in the field of high-fidelity simulations is exploitation of new computer architecture. And there has been a significant switch from CPU-based computing to GPU-based computing. And we don't know really where exactly what the shape of the future would be. And it's imagined that there will be hybrid systems. There will be processors that are dedicated to particular tasks and other hardware and so on. So to have a flow simulation technology which can handle this kind of heterogeneity and so on.
Right.
And so you don't have to rewrite a new code, a new solver every time the computer hardware changes and so on. So this is something that we are doing in collaboration with colleagues in computer science who have the domain expertise in terms of future hardware and future sort of software for execution of scientific programs and so on. So we're working with them to make sure that the software we are developing would work on sort of a variety of platforms.
CPU computers based, of the future, yes.
Well, computers affect us all in so many ways, from our phones to sort of the tools that we use in our scientific life.
Thanks to Sanjeev Lele. That was the future of fluid mechanics. You have been listening to The Future of Everything with Russ Altman on Sirius XM Business Radio, Channel 132.